It's Thursday, August 10th, 2017. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I'm usually talking to our capital muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. But this week, as listeners of the podcast know, Sean is out gallivanting out there in California. And I am at an undisclosed location in the Adirondacks with kind of limited internet access, which has been a plus and a minus, believe me. But this week's show, it's going to be a little bit of a different setup today. We've got a special interview I did with Karen Faridin of Burke's Gas Truth. This interview was conducted last week on the 3rd, shortly after we recorded our podcast, regular Out the Coop podcast, last week. And just as we were going to starting to conduct the interview, a bunch of news was breaking. So originally I was going to try to get this out much earlier in the week, but then the combination of the internet issues and then actually get an abscess in one of my teeth kind of put things a little bit behind. But so here we are. We're back kind of on schedule with our regular release this week. So in this week's show, most of the show will be the interview with Karen Faridin, and in that we're talking about the new severance tax and environmental regulations. There's this bill that Governor Wolf has been working with Republicans on in the Senate and calling for the severance tax on natural gas, which is something, again, Wolf did campaign on. But at the same time, there are a whole series of issues associated with this, not the least of which are the environmental trade-offs that Wolf is willing to trade away for to get this severance tax. But there's a really bigger issue there, and this is why I wanted Karen to come on. And she had recently had a piece in Raging Chicken Press talking about the severance tax, saying basically what Pennsylvania needs is not a severance tax, but it needs a ban on fracking. So we're going to get into that. We're going to get into some of the new FERC nominees that were just being released as we were going to record last week, talking about the Senate energy bill and the huge mess that is the Mariner East 2 pipeline and what that exposes about the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. So we hope that you'll stick in for today. It's quite an awesome interview, if I do say so myself. So, but just as a reminder, everybody, we do need you to keep Pull No Punches, Progressive Media going strong. So if you can, or else we'll keep on bugging you. I know it's kind of a pain. We want you to become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. All you got to do is go to the RagingChickenPress.org and look for the support and membership tab. You click become a member and you're on your way. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. You can make a one-time donation by clicking donate. We need you, the progressive community, to help us deepen Pull No Punches, Progressive Media, that will hold power accountable. So next week, Sean will still be away. He won't be back from his left coast adventures. We do know that Sean has had a chance to visit the Russian River Brewery. He's been out to multiple breweries, actually, since there. If you follow him on Instagram, I'm sure that you're enjoying some of the shots that he's been posting from Yosemite National Park, where he visited there. I'll probably have some images up coming for the Adirondacks. It's been cool. My kids have loved being able to do some boating and kayaking in the lakes up here. Before the beginning of the school year, which I will be going back to Kutztown University, when everything will ramp right up, it's one last chance to embrace summer, I guess. So this right after this, we're going to go to a break, and we'll come back with the interview I did with Karen Faridin last week from Burke's Gas Truth, and we will be talking about pipelines and natural gas in Pennsylvania. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. that was the day of the groundbreaking ceremony of what would come to be known as the greatest construction show on Earth. The show was the development of the St. Lawrence Seaway. The $1.2 billion project was a joint effort by Canada and the United States. It included the building of seven locks and widening of canals. The completed project would allow large cargo ships to travel all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to Duluth, Minnesota. It connected cities such as Chicago and Detroit to international trade routes to the east. The project also included the construction of a 3,216-foot-long hydroelectric dam. More than 22,000 engineers, carpenters, and laborers made the project possible. These workers dredged 360 million tons of materials and laid 6 million cubic yards of concrete. The massive construction project was finished in just 5 years. England's Queen Elizabeth II attended the opening ceremonies of the finished Seaway. Within the first 3 days, 168 vessels had traversed the new waterway. Jason Romano owned a trucking company that helped transport gravel to the project. He recalled, "The Seaway opened up the Great Lakes and brought ships to the heart of the country. And that is what makes this country great. The men who designed the project and worked with and under me are the unsung heroes." Jason's story, along with many other workers who made the project possible, were collected by Claire Parman in her book, The St. Lawrence Seaway and Power Project, an oral history of the greatest construction show on Earth. The book was released in 2009, commemorating 50 years since the completion of the massive project.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, here for the special edition of Out to Coop podcast. As you know, Sean, as we mentioned in the lead up today and the intro today, that Sean is somewhere in California, either hiking or searching out the latest in craft beer. Meanwhile, we're holding down the fort here in Pennsylvania, and I am so absolutely psyched to be joined by Karen Faraday of Burke's Gas Truth. We are, just as a reminder again, we are pre-recording this on August 3rd. And as we're actually getting ready for this show, there's been news breaking all morning. We expect there to be more going forward. But so keep that in mind. But Karen, thank you so much for joining me for this special edition of Out the Coop.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, you know, I can't say, I don't know what it is. It's good, bad thing, Karen, but you've got to be one of the busiest people I know ever since. Even, I mean, you were busy before Trump was elected, but now it seems like it's nonstop assault on the planet ever since this guy has taken office.
Well, that's definitely true. Things are hopping. It keeps me off the streets. That's how I look at it.
There you go. But you know what? Guess what? I can see you on the streets a whole lot too as well. So
maybe in the streets. Is
in
how
the
we
streets.
Talk about it.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, one of the things in the last couple of days, you had this great piece published in Raging Chicken on Daily Coast. Talking about the PA budget right now, they're looking to come for a deal of the funding. As you recall, the spending part was passed, but it was a shell of a budget because the Republicans and Democrats, Republicans really, they control it, like everything right up to the governor's office, but they had not come up, not cared to really deal with the revenue side of things, about how are you going to actually raise funds for this. And now we have seen that there is a tentative deal in the Senate basically to have a severance tax on natural gas. You recall Governor Tom Wolf campaigned on this, where to go for a severance tax, and that is going to help fund education and so on. There's been many of us right from the get-go who say, okay, yeah, Pennsylvania is kind of the outlier here, and the fact that we are the only state that has natural gas drilling does not have a severance tax. But given latest warnings from scientists that we've got, what, 3 years left, and if we do not address this, the issue of carbon emissions in the next 3 years and drastically, dramatically, we're in for catastrophic climate change here. So the severance tax also seems a way of a distraction away from where they really need to put our efforts. And so Karen, basically, again, go to RagingChickenPress.org, go to the Daily Coast. You can check her stuff out. We'll have links in the show notes. But came out strongly as soon as this the news was breaking about this, basically saying Pennsylvania does not need a severance tax. We need to ban fracking. So, Karen, why don't you take us through a little bit about why that piece now?
Well, thank you so much for letting me talk about this, because this really is critical. Back when Trump was elected, and you just mentioned how busy we are since Trump, I think it was incumbent upon the states to take action that we knew the federal government was not going to be taking action on with respect to climate change. It was clear that he wanted to pull out of Paris and roll back every environmental protection on the books. And so it really seemed like it was up to the states now to do the job that the federal government wasn't going to do. And that is not what happened in Pennsylvania. We have a governor who has done everything since he was inaugurated to expand the market for fossil fuels in Pennsylvania, and not just gas, but coal. He recently expanded. So, so we have a real problem here in Pennsylvania with somebody who is locking us into this addiction to fossil fuels for the next 100 years. I mean, they want to keep extracting this stuff. And the Democrats' point, and I've always said that the only difference in Pennsylvania between Republicans and Democrats is that Republicans want to give away our health, our safety, and our natural resources, and Democrats want to sell those things. Well, it would appear that finally they're getting close to that point where they've wanted to be for such a long time in the Democratic Party by having some sort of a severance tax agreed to that would allow them to sell those things. And that means that with that passage, should it be passed, we would institutionalize automatically fracking for the next many decades, if not 100 years. And we can't afford to do that. You said it exactly correctly, that we are out of time for dealing with climate change. And if people haven't been following the issues, why fracking factors into that so significantly is that when you're fracking in Pennsylvania anyway, you're fracking for two things really now. You're fracking for methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, 86 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. And the other big product in Pennsylvania right now that I can talk about if you'd like is ethane. And that contributes to climate change in three ways. One is that it's a greenhouse gas. Two is that it's a huge contributor to smog, which is the third leading cause of warming after carbon dioxide and methane. And then three, it inhibits methane's ability, once it's in the atmosphere, to convert to carbon dioxide, which is what would happen otherwise. It would meet up with hydroxides in the atmosphere and convert. Ethane inhibits that from happening. And so by ethane's presence in the atmosphere being increased, it allows for methane to remain there in its strongest form for a longer time. We don't have any chance of surviving climate change if we're going to let that kind of thing happen. And so it has to stop. And a severance tax is the absolute wrong direction to go, because that's going to institutionalize it.
Well, and this point on ethane is really important, too, especially since, going kind of full throttle on the Shell cracker plant. Right. Kind of out there in western Pennsylvania. And we see discussions of studies that are being done through the governor's office, basically, and through the Senate and the House, basically saying that Pennsylvania can support four more. Right. Mm-hmm. Four more cracker plants of this ethane. And I was, reading some articles. And what scares me about this, Karen, is that some of the report, a lot of the reporting is focused on one of two things. One is almost kind of like, the description of what this will do, like how this will translate the ethane cracker plant, how that will translate into diapers, right? How that will translate into all the plastics that will come out of that, right? Which is, part of the problem, let's just say that. And so they get into this stuff, and this is how much more products and how much more consumption we'll be able to have through these ethane cracker plants. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is so narrowly focused on kind of potential job creation and revenue from the state, which is a result of, the lack of revenue coming in the state is a result of decades of shock doctrine politics right here in Pennsylvania, right? We don't have the Scott Walker Walkers that kind of led the charge like they did out there in Wisconsin. But Governor Corbett and before them Rendell and now Governor Wolf are all on board this extractivism express that is going to bring us right kind of to the brink of disaster if we don't stop it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you said it correctly about the ethane plants, and it's not just the crackers. And I should mention that the cracker that was already approved in Beaver County, it's Royal Dutch Shell, they were given a $1.65 billion tax break. Well, I don't want to hear about a budget deficit if we have that kind of, you know, play with our, you know, with our budget to be able to give them those sorts of tax incentives to come into the state. The other thing that happened last year was that the biggest fine ever levied against a company that's in this ethane business as well as the methane business, and that's Range Resources. There was an $8.9 million fine levied against that company, the biggest one that DEP's ever levied. They reversed it. Try fining these companies. Why don't we try charging them the taxes that are already on the books? There are plenty of them that they don't pay. You know, why aren't we trying to get the money out of these companies that they should be paying? Why not fine the companies when they do the many, many, many bad things they do? And why give these companies huge tax breaks to come into the state and just do more bad things that you're not going to fine them over? I mean, it just makes no sense. And what makes anybody think severance tax since they've gotten out of paying everything else they've ever been required to pay by law? So there are so many reasons that the severance tax on its own doesn't make any sense. But what you're talking about with the ethane to create more business, to create more single-use plastics that will gum up the oceans and kill aquatic life, how does this make any sort of sense? And ethane is the big product behind the Mariner East 2 pipeline as well. And so it's not just the cracker plants that we're building so we can extract the ethylene to create the single-use plastics. We're now shipping it across the state in its raw form and its ethane form to Marcus Hook, where it goes overseas so that others can do the same.
Now, as we speak right now, since you brought up the Mariner East 2 pipeline, that right now, it was still held up in court. Is that correct?
Well, you know, not entirely.
Not entirely.
What they did was they halted all drilling. So the problem has been with that pipeline that the drilling that's going on, the horizontal directional drilling that goes on in the course of laying the pipeline so that they don't have to go through something, but they can go under it. That's been causing lots and lots of spills that have led to contamination of an aquifer in one place, massive spills in another part of the state, contaminated water supplies, people who now need to be put on public water because their wells have gone bad, and all of that just to lay the pipeline. And that is not a different process from any regular old natural gas line. That's a process that's used all the time, and it's a very troublesome process. So that drilling was halted. Then the companies start going back to them saying, well, can we just do it here? Because we were really close to finishing here and that sort of thing. So there actually are places where they're still allowed to drill until next week when they're maybe
there's
it's the following
hearing,
week.
Right?
I'm getting my dates mixed up. I think it's next week when the hearing is occurring in Harrisburg, the Environmental Hearing Board. So most of it has been stopped, but it's just the drilling and not even all of the drilling.
It's crazy. This concerned me. The other thing that's a lot of people have been talking about now, again, this is reporting, and I've watched this slow creep that from talking strictly Marcellus to now talking about Utica Shale. I remember a few years back when they were originally, I think it was Range Resources, if I'm correct, was out there, and they were seeking property rights from from homeowners out there for Marcellus Shale, but they had these addendums in there for Utica because the Utica Shale runs underneath there and it's deep. Right. So the kind of extreme extraction that we get through horizontal fracking of Marcellus becomes even more complicated, even potentially more devastating when we're talking about the Utica Shale. Kind of an unexplored horizon on how much we're going to kind of rip out of the ground here. Now, one of the things that you said, in this piece, I want to go back to it for a bit, because I think it was important that You have not been like all of a sudden a convert to saying, you know, we should not have a severance tax. Right. This is something, is a case that you have been making for a while, and you have been making directly with Governor Wolf. Now, on Out the Coop, Sean and I have been talking quite a bit. You know, we've been basically calling him, you know, Tom Carbon Wolf on the podcast, because he doesn't seem like, you know, there's, you know, not a bit of carbon in the ground that he doesn't want to get out. And this is the guy who's you know, he's a Democrat, right? He was the one who was hailed as progressive and all this kind of stuff. But he seems to be wanting to kind of trade away this resource for kind of short-term gain, which is actually not all that different from his criticisms of the Republicans about their budget, their, you know, little budget fixes and gimmicks that they make. But what concerns me even more, so you've been kind of with Wolf on this and saying, warning him of these possibilities and what we're facing there. My fear is we get these pipelines approved, and it seems like some of the hokey pokey that they're doing with the severance tax in the bill in terms of privatizing some of the permitting processes and so on is virtually a green light to let these pipelines go. But it weds the communities around where the extraction is taking place, especially around the cracker plants and so on, to those industries for that much longer. So it builds up a kind of resistance, you know, so the kind of jobs for future exchange, right? What do you want? You want a job now to feed your kids, right? Or do you want a future that, you know, is probably going to be devastating anyways, right? And that seems to be the setup here. So could you walk us a little bit through the case that you've been making to the governor about why he should not be like, you know, just putting this stuff in the pipeline, no pun intended, to wreck our future?
Well, there's so much to say about this, but basically my argument started 7 years ago when I started making it, when I founded Berks Gas Truth, based on a report from the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center that you mentioned earlier is actually supporting the severance tax. And the report I cited back then was their report in support of a severance tax back then. As I never made sense to me, because they made the perfect case against the severance tax, and I already alluded to it. All of the taxes that were already on the books, they went right down the list and they identified every single thing that the industry was finding their way out of, like state sales tax or hotel tax for all those workers that don't come from Pennsylvania, by the way, or, you know, federal taxes as a result of low tax rates within the state, taking advantage of the Delaware loophole, filing out of state so that they didn't have to pay Pennsylvania's corporate tax of 9.9%. But if they did file in state and 15% of them at the time were filing in state, they were filing as limited liability corporations so that they could actually file as individuals, you know, corporations being people, and then paying the personal income tax rate of 3.3%. And so, you know, it made no sense at the time that if they're obviously finding their way out of every one of these taxes, you know, again, why enact another one when they're not paying the ones that are already on the books? And what makes anybody think they're going to pay this one? And so that was my original argument. But there have been so many other things since then. For instance, one of the reasons why Governor Wolf is making a market for this gas and working so hard to do it is because there isn't a market for the gas. Climate scientists are telling us to leave 80% of fossil fuels in the ground if we have any chance at all of saving this planet. And so to be building the market at this time makes no sense whatsoever, especially when the kinds of things that he's been doing don't actually help us, because he's creating a market that isn't necessary, because there's just no market in existence for that gas. Nobody is experiencing gas shortages. There's been a glut of gas. That's why he's doing this. And so if you put in place a severance tax, he will officially become salesperson in chief for the natural gas industry. That will be his job, because every program person out there who has a very worthy program that needs funding desperately will be after him to get every molecule out of the ground, like you alluded to earlier. That's what they're going to be going after, everything, because they're going to need to get every dime of severance tax out of these companies to pay for those programs. And I think all of those programs deserve better solutions than to be tied to a boom bust industry that has already gone bust more than once in the decade that it's been around in the state. So it just makes no sense, no matter how you look at it. And the kind of things that he's doing, he took $24 million in his pipe program away from alternative energy to put it toward more natural gas distribution lines that would service schools and hospitals, big customers, in other words, so that he can have big institutional customers using natural gas. And the way that the program works, by the way, is that they award grants to put in this last mile of distribution line, so to speak, that you need to reach these customers. One of the first recipients was a company called Glenn O. Halbaker from State College. They have an extraction business, an excavation business, mm-hmm. I should say. And they got one of the grants to a $1 million grant to connect to natural gas service because it's also available for some businesses. And Glenn O. Halbaker actually contributed to Wolf's campaign, and they're a member of the Marcellus Shell Coalition. So that's who gets the grants.
this is nuts. I mean, on the one hand, as you're describing this, it seems like one policy out of sheer desperation, right? I'm going to find money wherever we can, no matter what the cost, which, again, that's exactly the point of shock doctrine politics, right? That you basically strip away and you starve public resources by demanding kind of no taxes, low taxes, and giveaways to the rich. Until people are kind of looking around to support for crumbs. And the sad part about it is that this is the cyclical, you know, history of Pennsylvania. I mean, you got oil, then you got coal, and now we got gas. And this is devastating.
Yeah, I mean, look at what Governor Wolf ran on. I mean, there was that one commercial where he's in a classroom with kids and he says, hey, we're going to pay for education with that stuff under your seats. And then some kids like listening to the ground with a plastic, of course, paper, you know, plastic cup to hear what's under there. And the rest of them are looking at him like he's nuts. But, you know, he says, we're going to pay for your education with the stuff under your seat. So what he's saying is, I'm going to tie your education to a boom bust industry and I'm just not going to worry about climate change at all. And in so doing, what he said was he was going to make both of those really important things the next guy's problem, and he got elected.
Yep. And I think, you know, this goes right to the point which you made in a previous piece in Raging Chicken about, climate denial Democrat style.
Yep.
This is exactly it, right? This is kind of, you know, he's not saying that the science is wrong. Right. He's not saying that, climate scientists aren't there or there's not global warming. It's just a willful, like, ignoring of the consequences of this. And, you know, and again, there was this time where I think the argument that, Obama was making about this being a transition fuel, natural gas being a transition fuel and all that, which, I mean, you for a long time, you know, poking holes in that every step along the way. But I think that had some traction in the population as a whole for a while, right? It made sense because we experience it as consumers, right? And, you know, by turning on our gas stove, right? Or kind of not having to have oil heating our house with the residue and stuff that comes with it, but having quote unquote clean burning natural gas right now. But where we are now is no longer there. I think that the people that are supporting this are no longer people that are just saying, yeah, you know, maybe that's what we need to do in order to get to that clean future. They're people that are supporting it out of sheer desperation. Right, out of saying, well, there is no more money to fund our schools. So, hey, if that's what we got to do to make our kids have an education, that's what we got to do.
Well, there's also that point of view that says, hey, they're never going to ban fracking anyway, so why not make money for it and put it back into the environment to do remediation? Well, first of all, you don't get to remediate the climate. You know, I mean, that problem is, you know, just rolling forward, accelerating it with every day, day.
And when you start talking about aquifers, you don't get aquifers back.
You don't get them back. That's right. So even the stuff that's happening on the ground and has been happening on the ground and is just getting worse as this sort of cancer spreads with pipelines across the state. And, you know, it was Secretary Quigley at the DEP before he left who said that this would affect just about every county in the state. So it's a spreading problem. So forget the climate part of it. Just the on the ground impacts have been so profound that, you know, it would take more money, far more money than we will ever take in a severance tax, even if every dime of it went to remediate the environment. Forgetting climate change and the costs of that, natural disasters and droughts and all the things that, you know, are costing us huge sums of money on this planet now with respect to climate change without even thinking about what it's going to be like 100 years from now. So, you know, for even just putting all of that aside, the impacts on the ground right now at 10,000 wells in the ground is more than we would ever be able to pay for with every dime of impact or severance tax money that we would ever get.
Well, you know, and I think of one of the things that John Fetterman ran on, right, when he was running for running for Senate. And one of the things he talked about is about the forgotten towns, right? He talked about the people left behind. And here we see it being reenacted out in real time, because it's those same exact communities that have been devastated by coal or the aftermath of coal are right in the targets of this all over again. And this is crazy.
That point, when I give talks about fracking, I show a map that shows the map filling in with all the permits that have been granted. And you can see the arc of the Marcellus. You can see it right there. And you know that when they go to drill the next well, they're not coming to Berks County. There isn't gas here where I am. They're going to go back to those same towns who have been hit over and over and over again, not just with fracking, but like you said, with coal in many parts of the state. And they're going to be hit over and over and over again. And I talk to people every day. I work with these people. They can't take it anymore at 10,000 wells. There's no way they can deal with 100,000 wells. No way.
Yeah, well, you know, we have Republican legislators who continue to try to want to pass these kind of criminalization of pipeline protests. So maybe they will have a fine way of dealing with it. Just going to throw them in the slammer, right? Just get them out of the way, Karen. That's, you know, there you go. Then we're done.
Yeah, out of the way, no problem. Out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, federal housing and everything. How about that? So so speaking of federal stuff, you know, again, we got so much going on the ground here in Pennsylvania. It's incredible. But, you know, I almost think we need like four or five sets of eyes to pay attention to everything that's going on. Because just you brought this to my attention right before we're going on air today. Is right news, it's breaking. It looks like before we get the recess, we may actually get the votes on the FERC nominees, Trump's FERC nominees. Then we're going to be on like, you know, full steam ahead on the permitting process and the moving on the pipelines, right?
Right. The way it works is that not all pipelines are regulated the same way. So the ones that we talk about a lot in Pennsylvania, which are the natural gas lines, as opposed to the natural gas liquids lines, like Mariner East 2, the natural gas lines like PennEast and Atlantic Sunrise, those are regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission during their construction, during the application process. So it's really that commission that gets to approve pipelines or say no to them, but they never say no to them. In all the 30 years that they've had approval process or the authority to approve pipelines, they've said no to one out of, in the last 20 years I counted, it was 450 just in 20 of the 30 years.
Well, that just shows you how safe pipelines are, Karen, right?
Yeah, they're all wonderful. So they said no to one, and that was days after they were sued by the Delaware Riverkeeper Network for conflict of interest. And that pipeline is up now once again. It's been resubmitted.
Yep.
So it might likely get, you know, approved as well, since they approve everything that they see. They hardly ever meet a pipeline they don't like. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that they are responsible for an environmental review that really isn't their strength. And so, you know, these are people who are usually market regulators of, you know, energy markets, not environmental regulators of impacts of pipelines. So it's been a problem forever. There are endless conflicts of interest going on there. Abuses of their power, eminent domain is a huge issue. Lots and lots of problems. And we've been going after, and when I say we, I'm talking about a coalition of more than 200 organizations regionally and around the country that have been going after the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and calling on Congress to investigate them. And that hasn't happened. So when FERC lost its quorum in February, when Trump ousted the chair at the time, they were already down a couple of members when he asked the chair, rather than just resume a seat on the committee, he just decided to leave the commission altogether. So all of a sudden in February, the commission was down to two members. One of them has since retired. Her term was up. So now we have one FERC commissioner out of five. Trump nominated two more rabidly pro-fossil fuel nominees. One of them is from Pennsylvania, from the PUC, Robert Paulson. He's the one who said recently that those of us engaged in pipeline fights are engaged in jihad. That's who they're putting on this thing if they get their way. And so the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee is the group that has to see these nominees and approve them before they can go to the floor for a full Senate vote. So those two went through they were approved with only three Democrats voting no, by the way, and that was Sanders, Wyden, and Hirono. Everybody else, all these senators who wrote these climate letters to, you know, to President Trump saying, don't pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, all approved these people. Bear that in mind.
So, people, I want you to write those three names down. Sanders, Hirono, and who?
Wyden. Ron Wyden.
Right. There's your three that voted against this, right? Mm-hmm. So this is why you hear us talk. I mean, I know that we get some flack for this, for kind of going after Democrats, but this is why we do this, right? That the only way these people do the right thing is when you apply pressure. That is it. These are not capital G good people, right? I don't mean to say they're horrible people. I mean, see, they're not necessarily our friends when it comes to protecting the environment and the climate.
It's more that climate denial Democrat style, you know, again, impassioned letters to, you know, Trump, don't pull out of Paris, and grand statements. They couldn't run fast enough to the podium as soon as he did pull out of Paris to make their impassioned remarks about how crazy it was. But then days later, literally within a week of that, they were approving these candidates who are going to do nothing but approve pipelines and reestablish the quorum. And that's key right now, because if they both get voted on today, which is the day it could happen, now we're being told, they're both going to be on that commission. It only takes two to reestablish a quorum. And then every one of those pipelines that has been held off because of this lack of a quorum will be approved. I mean, they've already indicated they want to get busy and start getting back to work and getting this thing back, you know, get the boat back on course and all of that nonsense. So that's what's going to happen, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see anything standing in the way of this either, too, as well. I mean, I think that the likelihood that they're going to get voted down is slim. I mean, given the fact that you've got so many Democrats are on the side of approving this stuff, getting moving, because they want to be, you know, they want to kind of check their political boxes about saying that, you know, they're on the side of jobs, even though we know these are jobs are fleeting, number one, right? And the most jobs that it creates down the road are people who are going to have to clean up the mess years down. And that was going to be minimum wage, poorly taken, probably by that time, prison labor to clean up the mess decades down the road when people have forgotten how we got there to begin with. So this
could be done on taxpayer dollars.
On taxpayer dollars, exactly.
I mean, the industry isn't paying for any of this stuff. In Pennsylvania, we have this big, huge problem of orphaned and abandoned wells. And, you know, every one of them needs to be capped at least every 25 years. There are hundreds of thousands of them. They haven't even gotten through the vast majority of them at the rate that they're going right now. To hit them all once, it would take them 21,505 years. That's how long. And it has to be done every 25 years, at least. It should be probably shorter than that to prevent methane from leaking out of all of these wells. The Act 13 controversial law that went into effect a few years ago, a lot of it was excised by the Supreme Court. But the part that remains includes a well bonding fee of $10,000. Every new well that goes, you know, offline, a Marcellus generation well, in other words, Utica generation well, it takes at least $100,000 to cap it once. So, you know, that's what we're going to be paying for, to save our own butts. You know, it's going to be your children and then their children and generations going forward in perpetuity having to deal with this.
Yeah, this is why, you know, again, I don't see how anybody, you know, I've got two young kids. I've got an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old. Right. And I don't know how anybody that has kids. I mean, everybody in general, too. But I mean, I look at my kids and, like, you know, you think about their future right away, and their future really quickly runs right up against that wall of catastrophic climate change. Like, I don't know how anybody in good conscience, like, I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, progressive. If you're just thinking about the future of your kids, like we're supposed to care about, we want to leave things better for them. We want them to have a better opportunity. There is no way under these conditions that this happens. Nope. So, you know, I mean, it's nuts. So we've got that. So this, we're going to watch this. We're going to have to come back. We're going to come back to what happens in the FERC, because my guess is by the time Sean returns from California and we're doing this, this is a 2 weeks lapse, that we're going to see some rapid movement on pipeline approvals and this kind of stuff. If assuming these nominees go forward, all the more reason, folks, pressure, 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 pressure. Call your senators, call your representatives, and get in the streets on this one, because it is our futures we're talking about. The good shining light, I guess, in this, on Karen, is that we've got this amazing, you know, really hopeful, forward-looking Senate energy bill, right?
Yeah, fantastic news there. Well, you know, this is another thing that ties into the FERC topic we were just talking about, because the energy bill It actually expands FERC's power. And in fact, the House just passed two bills that are similar. One of the bills actually takes away that presidential border crossing authority that Obama used to stop the Keystone XL pipeline.
Really?
It takes it away from the president and gives it to FERC.
Wow. Wow.
Now, that's the House. They already passed that one. The Senate energy bill does all sorts of other things in addition to expanding FERC's powers at a time when we have been calling on them to get on FERC for all of the abuses of power. They want to expand those powers. And they also want to do things like expediting LNG exports, and FERC would have a role in letting that all happen much more quickly. And LNG refers to liquefied natural gas that would be liquefied methane gas, in other words, and it's a very cumbersome, expensive, dangerous process to do that on ports, you know, different places along the coast of the United States where these facilities would be built that would liquefy it and then send it overseas again to the highest bidder. So there goes that domestic energy that we're all supposed to be so excited about.
Right.
And that would, of course, you know, jack up prices for energy in this country because we'd be competitors for our own energy. Nevertheless,
it's like, I swear to God, it's like, this is insane. It's like, you know, it's like living in like a hall of mirrors. You know, what you have to do in order to kind of make sense of what's kind of moving forward. But that's exactly what it's designed to do, right? It's designed to get us so that right. We don't know which way to look to understand what is going on. And so you throw your hands up in the air and you just like, forget it. You know, it's like living inside an Escher maze, right? I mean, it's nuts.
Right. It is, exactly. And then you greenwash the name of something like the Clean Power Plan last year, you know,
yeah, right.
And we're already dealing with all of the problems out of that, even though basically Trump killed that. But the legacy of that badly named, you know, greenwash named plan is that Pennsylvania now has 47 new natural gas power plants approved that we have to fight, every single one of them, because every one of them will mean more pipelines, more fracking, more into the atmosphere, killing us that much faster. So we have all these terrible bills, all this terrible stuff going on in the state, like you said, confusing everyone. Meanwhile, I should just make the point for the plus side of all the good side. There is a side here is that everybody pretty much knows now that bridge fuel idea was nonsense.
Yep.
And where's the bridge?
Yep.
And so there are people with a plan, though. The Delaware Riverkeeper Network has a plan for Pennsylvania that experts came up with to show that, yeah, you need to use fossil fuels to get off of fossil fuels. There needs to be a transition. But if you use the right mix and you do the right sort of conservation programs, no, not going and living in a cave like our detractors like to say we're telling people to do, but actually cutting back in smart ways and ways that, you know, turn off a light now and then, you know. I mean, simple things we can all do to conserve energy. Meanwhile, using the right mix of conventional fuels, not extreme fossil fuels like fracked gas, mountaintop removal coal, tar sands, by using conventional forms of fuel, we can make it through the transition and be done with all of this by 2050. And we actually need to be done with it by then. Some programs even talk about doing it sooner, 2035. So there are ways to be off of the grid by 2030, by almost anybody's plan, off of everything by 2050, by, again, the most generous plan. And it can be done with fossil fuels used in a smart way, but there needs to be commitment to a plan. And everywhere that green energy is being done, green energy jobs outpace fossil fuel jobs. Everywhere.
Well, absolutely. And I look at right now what we're on the cusp of, right? And, you know, Sean and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, too, as well. We're living at a moment, right? And, you know what? And I know I tend, this is kind of the person I am. I tend to focus on, like, you know, the insanity, right? And then it can't look, and I recognize the downfall of that, right? Because, I mean, you're right to kind of correct this, you know, conversation a little bit and say, well, let's remember here, this is not all just doom and gloom and hopelessness here. Because we're at the point in history right now where Volvo has said, right, within like a short number of years, right, 2020 or something like this, that all of their cars will either be all electric or hybrid, right? BMW making the same commitments. We see right now we're living with, you know, just what, 3 weeks ago, the Tesla 3 comes out, right? That's actually puts it within range of more people. Again, it's still a little pricey, coming in like $35,000, $38,000, but, you know, under current tax credits, it brings it down to $28,000. And that's a lot cheaper than an SUV right now, I'll tell you that, right? And you've got like, you've got the Chevy Volt, and now you've got the Bolt that's out there. The Bolt, which is actually coming in, was a better that gets you better mileage. You know, if we can see if we use that word, than even the Tesla 3. So we're at this point, and you look at that and you say, well, what's standing in the way of expanding that dramatically? And I said, there's only two things: one, a commitment to build out the infrastructure for charging stations and so on, and secondly, like a green lighting of solar panels, like and tax credits to incentivize solar panels, like in all communities. If you did that, right, and again, in order to build the solar panels, in order to build out that stuff, you're going to have to expend fossil fuels. There's no doubt about that, right? But what you're doing is you're taking steps in those kind of directions. And things that once had seemed to be kind of a little like fantastical, right? It'd be, you know, again, even like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, people think, yeah, electric cars, blah, blah, blah. But we're there. And so it's no longer a question of technological feasibility. It's no longer a question of, do we know what's going on? It's a matter of political will. And, you know, I tend to look at it like this, is that even though we've got – I don't think technical solutions is like, you know, that's not the end-all answer. But what it is that I think that the solution is actually a lot simpler than it is. As crazy as they're trying to make us, the solution is simple like this. It's organized power – right? Demand a stop, stand in the way, and pressure. That is it, right? So as complicated as they want to make all the problems that they're putting in our way, the solution is like what it's always been. It's organized resistance, period.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, the Senate energy bill that we were talking about a minute ago has a renewable energy section that does not mention solar or wind.
Blows my mind.
Yeah, so that's what we're dealing with. And so actually, I am getting ready to launch something I'd love to come back and talk about when it's launched.
Awesome.
Because I'm too busy with pipelines right now and everything else and FERC and all of it. But I'd like to come back at some point, if you'll have me, to
Absolutely.
Talk about this statewide campaign I'm launching called 100% PA. It's 100% renewable energy and 100% sustainable solutions for 100% of Pennsylvanians. And the idea being that, you know, what I said at the top about how, you know, we were supposed to be sort of counting, I think, on our state governments to do for us what federal governments were not going to, or the federal government was not going to be doing under Trump. When that proved not to be true in a place like Pennsylvania, it occurred to me that we have to now do things in spite of our government, not right. just spending our time pressuring them, but we have to just start doing it ourselves.
That's a great point.
Which is sort of how it's always been. We just have to take the, you know, bull by the horns and get it done, which is what a lot of mayors are already doing. And so this idea for this campaign is to be amplifying all of the good things that are actually happening in this state. I was at a Green Jobs event in Allentown not long ago, and I could not believe the number of green jobs that already exist in this state. But you never hear about them. I think of them as like these cells trying to struggle to survive mm-hmm. in an inhospitable environment. You know, it's just, it's not promoted, it's not supported in a big way, but they're there. And there are lots of great programs already happening and lots of great, you know, initiatives by mayors who joined in the climate, you know, we're still in plans and all that stuff. There's all this stuff happening. There's lots of big organizations that are trying to organize people around, you know, Ready for 100 and off fossil fuels and all of that kind of stuff that just needs to be brought together, amplified, let people make the connections so that we can just start doing it ourselves. Coming up with the plan for our municipality about how we're going to get off of fossil fuels and forget the state government, because they're clearly not with us. I have sat there and talked to the governor. I've talked to members of his cabinet, and you show them the science. You introduce them to scientists to tell them themselves. You talk, you know, bring in impacted people to talk to them about all of the things they've been through. They listen, they take notes, they smile, they look sympathetic, and then they say, we think we can do this safely. Based on what?
Right.
They have nothing to support their side.
La, 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 fingers in the ears, hands over the eyes. That's what, based on what? That's really what it is.
Yep. Yep. Well, so now it's time. We just got to circumvent them now.
Well, you know, so because I, you know, I teach at Kutztown University. And one of the things that I will talk to students about when they're doing any kind of organizing and things like this, I actually do an exercise in one of my advanced composition classes when we were talking about, we do climate change as kind of like a test case. When we kind of look at it, then we start talking about solutions. And I always say, you know, one of the problems that that is faced when we start talking about solutions, it's all way up here, like way heady in the air, abstract ideas. How do we solve this global thing? And I say, well, instead of doing that, let's flip it around. Let's talk about building it from the ground up, arguing from the ground up. Say, here at Kutztown University, what could you do, right, that would have a direct impact upon this? We know what the problem is. It's not a question about knowledge. It's a question mm-hmm. of will and thinking, and then, you know, getting around the cynicism or getting around the despair, really. Right. And so we end up looking at examples like, you know, hey, right down in Philadelphia, they started painting buildings roofs white. instead of black. They start look at the, you know, the Eagles stadium, the greenest stadium, right, in the entire country. Right. That, you know, again, it's not perfect. Right. But, you know, you've got these are real initiatives that have happened. And when people think about Philadelphia, the last thing they think about with Philadelphia is that it's a green city other than Eagles. Right. They think about it as like, oh, you know, it's a working class town. So they associate that with industry and dirt. No, no, no. It's got some really important industries that are going on. Look what's happening. You mentioned in Allentown. If you look at some of the build out that's going on there. And again, there's lots of complications of that. We'd have to get on that. But there's really important initiatives that are already there. And once you start flipping around that perspective, which is why, you know, I'm thrilled to hear you're doing this, flipping around that perspective and say, no, look, we can't go to Paris climate thing and solve it all right there. Let's start doing it right here, right now.
Yeah.
In our own backyards. Well, you know, one thing I wanted to get your perspective on, like, before we go, I've kept you a long time, I know, but it's like every time I get talking to you about this stuff, it's just, you know, one, my blood boils, like, but also, you know, it makes me feel good, I guess, in that sense that, you know, look, the work that you're doing is having an impact. The work that you're doing is so critical. And the fact that you're busy, you know, I know it sucks for you sometimes, but it also, I think, is you know, everybody else needs to hear this. It's like, you know, when Karen said you started Burke's Gas Truth, what, 7 years ago, you said?
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean, you know, that is, you know, Burke's Gas Truth, you're sitting there in Kutztown, right? You know, like, you'll start this thing because we need to. And now, right, in a relatively short period of time, right, you're talking about really helping define the debate about where we go and move forward, right? And as you always say, right, you're not doing this by yourself, right? You're doing this with a whole series of other organizations and individuals across the state and across the country, really, right? Mm-hmm. This kind of network of power that is really having that impact. So that's pretty awesome. One of the things I just want to get your perspective on, because this is one that kind of hit me hard earlier this week, is that one of the most amazing examples I saw, both in terms of strategy, in terms of its symbolic, the way that it kind of embraced like the symbolism of taking a stand of resistance, was the stand in Lancaster, right? And we just, you know, if for people who haven't, I mean, if you listen to this podcast, you've heard us talk about this like endlessly. You had this giant barn, right, that, you know, says, welcome to the stand on it every weekend, nonviolent direct action trainings, kind of building this giant, you know, looks like a, you know, like a deer stand, except, you know, with a house on top, you know, building gates, right, to prevent the pipelines coming through. Is this 107 acre farm in Lancaster, outside Lancaster, kind of Stoga, I guess. Yeah. And that had been this kind of really focal point for resistance. There's a group of local nuns had set up a chapel there and we're blessed. I mean, it was amazing space. And we just got word this week that that Williams, who's building that pipeline, has bought the farm, the whole 107 acres of it. My first thought was, oh, man, this was. You know, our standing rock in a way, right? I mean, we hadn't gotten to that point where there's a direct confrontation, but that was the way the vibe of the place and the theory and the strategy behind that was very much informed by the same kind of like community-based kind of resistance, right? Embracing local cultures and customs and background and so on. And now I can't imagine that Williams is going to say, hey, you know what? You guys, you can keep the barn and all the nonviolent action stuff like that, right?
Right.
You know, we know they're going to oust them right away. And the Lancaster Against Pipelines has come out and said, you know, again, my favorite quote from them was that, look, the stand is not a property, right? It is a grassroots movement, and we'll be moving forward. And that was heartening to hear because that felt devastating to me. And I'm curious, you're just like, take on where we are with that.
Yeah, well, I should also mention on Mariner East 1, speaking of Standing Rock of Pennsylvania, that's the same company now. That's Energy Transfer Partners on that pipeline. And there's another group called Camp White Pine that's in Huntington County that's
right
up in trees doing very similar things. But getting back to Atlantic Sunrise, which is just a terrible situation, this family had given over that property, that area of their property, to the stand, to Lancaster Against Pipelines and everyone else to put that encampment together. And then they were persuaded after a long time, after a lot of pressure. I mean, nobody's happy about it, but, you know, they were put under a lot of pressure by the company to make this deal. They were given an awful lot of money to make the deal. And we think it had everything to do with, of course, the fact that the stand was there. That property was more important to them than many others yep. that are on the pipeline route where they still haven't settled. So other landowners have already offered, that's the good news, to give space to Lancaster Against Pipeline so they can reestablish their stand. But like you said, it's not a place. It's a movement. It's who they are. It's with them wherever they are. And the really good news is that the chapel is owned by nuns on a different property, and that chapel is still there, and they're having vigils at that chapel all the time now. And so that's going to be more of a focal point, I would imagine, until they can get reestablished physically somewhere else for the people to come and join them, literally. But the stand doesn't go anywhere. The stand is everybody. The 14th is a big next proceeding on Lancaster Against Pipeline side, where they are been. So the thing I was getting confused with my dates about earlier in the thing, the 7th, 8th, and 9th is a Mariner East thing at the Environmental Hearing Board about all the spills. The 14th is when the DEP is going to have another public hearing having to do with air quality permits, having to do with the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline. And what we want DEP to do at this point, and what we've done with all of these pipeline fights across the state, is we've issued these letters coming from every one of them, and it's a vote of no confidence against the DEP. Because what everybody has to remember is that the big problems with Mariner East right now are largely the DEP's fault for not regulating these things properly, for showing no oversight. The only way that they get to stop a pipeline is to protect the water. They don't have a lot of authority over pipelines. FERC has a lot of authority. Other entities have authority, like PUC in Pennsylvania. They don't have much except to protect the water. And they issue those permits like candy. And it's time for that to stop. And so that's what Atlantic Sunrise has going for it right now, is that no matter how much Williams threatens and is talking about eminent domain and has been running these nuns into court all the time over their property, they still don't have the permits they need to build a pipeline. And if the DEP says no, that's the end of that pipeline. That's as simple as that. And so we're going to call on DEP really hard over the next few weeks. So everybody paying attention needs to get on the DEP to say, do your jobs, protect the water. You are completely justified in saying no to these pipelines over just water, because water impacts are profound. But by doing that, by protecting the thing you're supposed to be protecting under the permits, you're protecting everything else at the same time. It's time to start doing that for Pennsylvania, because these guys could not have been more sympathetic to the industry at every single turn in my 7 years doing this.
And I hear you. You know, one of the, I love this idea about, you know, going after the DEP right now, too, and put pressure on them. Send your letters, send your emails and so on. We'll look for put links down down in the show notes here, too, as well. What the other thing I think is a really interesting strategy is like, you know, hey, let's look up. Hey, what building is the DEP in? What does it look like to go to the DEP itself? Because guess what? Those people are used to doing their jobs outside of the public scrutiny. They're used to kind of not being the ones in the limelight. People go to the Capitol, they go to the senators and all that kind of stuff. So we start showing up at their place of work, right? Showing up in their offices there. And, you know, it was a good thing, you know, during we talked about this in the podcast last week when there was the People's Budget protest or rally in the state capitol last month. That after that rally, right, you know, which again, you have a rally and rallies are rallies, right? But then you had people went and did the lobbies and that kind of stuff. And there was a lot of folks there. What SCIU did after that, SCIU and One Pennsylvania and a bunch of other groups that were there, they actually said went outside the Capitol then, and they went to, you know, the Manufacturers Association. They went to the lobbyists. They went to the lawyers who have been kind of like, you know, handing over our futures, you know, to these climate destroyers. And they said, and they put notices on them. We're serving you notice that unless you respond to this, we are coming back for you, right? And that idea, we are going to bring the fight directly to you. And I thought that was really important as a way of thinking about how we go about resistance. Like, yes, we've got the political folks, but that kind of points of pressure are all around us. They're in our towns, right, in terms of kind of local approval boards and city councils. They're in, you know, obviously the kind of political other things, but also in the agencies that are responsible for this. So make your voice heard. So crazy. So, Karen, things that we should be paying attention to in the near future, things that that you want to kind of put on the table for everyone to hear today. What else you got before we have to take off?
Yeah, so definitely keep paying attention to that severance tax debate going on. Given when this might air, I'm not sure when a vote could occur. And, you know, so it might be old news by then, but keep paying attention to that. Definitely follow this FERC nominee thing, because you know, if it does get done today, there's still two other nominees. We still have to keep fighting, and we have to fight every single pipeline approval after that. We have a bunch of them right here in Pennsylvania. Like I said, right here in Berks County, where I am, we have the DTE pipeline that connects to a power plant we're trying to stop. So look for our, you know, cases against power plants throughout the state, but right here in Berks and Birdsboro, we're trying to stop one there. Look for the Senate Energy Bill. Look for, everything coming up with, like I said, 100% PA, and all of these groups are trying to do the right thing and put forward these initiatives. You said about Philadelphia being a great green city. It also happens to be a place where they're talking about Philly as a gas hub.
Right.
You know, they're trying to do every lousy thing in Philadelphia they can with refineries and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, so I think one of the things about doing our things our way, you know, advancing the right agenda, the clean agenda our way, just makes their agenda look more foolish. So look for more of that. You know, I hope to have the website up so everybody can find all those great programs. Get involved. Naomi Klein, who wrote Shock Doctrine that you referred to earlier on this show, she also wrote a book called This Changes Everything. And so the key thing is, whether you're following any one of these things I just mentioned, the key thing is to remember that to address climate change, it does mean systemic change. It means if you're going after a bank, do that. If it means that you're putting an organic garden in, do that. Whatever it is that calls to you, that you feel passionate about, that's what you should be doing. There's room for you to be doing whatever it is. You fit in wherever your passions lie. So don't think that you have to be anti-fracking or be with me fighting, you know, in the weeds, crazy policies and things. If you're interested in something else, getting a bike lane put in your town, anything is important right now. It all has to change, and we have to work together to get it done.
Yeah, and I think that's the key right there, is that the working together, is that once you start asking yourself how to get, say, like a bike line, a bike lane put in your town, how you get to kind of block off these roads and have a park there, like, instead, to encourage walking within your town, little things like that, not only is that good for policy, not only is that good for, kind of promoting a green future, right? Or a future free of catastrophic climate change. How about that? Right. It means that you have to get out there and work with others, right? You have to talk with your neighbors. You have to talk with people in your community. And once you start kind of coming with that, I'm always amazed at the creative energy and the creative power of people when they put their mind to trying to solve a problem in productive ways for everybody. As much as the loudmouths, front building in many ways, it's really the persistent, caring work that is done on the ground in communities, both big and small, across this country and across this world, that actually get things done. So,
I mean, right here in Berks County, we have defeated a pipeline. We have defeated a gas to liquids facility, which was crazy bad. It was the craziest proposal ever made, because it would have been the first one in the United States across the street from a daycare center. I mean, it was nuts. So anyway, it didn't take money. I mean, everybody was putting in their own money, but it didn't take anything close to what the industry was throwing at that project for communities to get it done. And it wasn't me. It was lots of people in their communities talking to each other, organizing together. That's how you succeed. It doesn't take piles of money. They have all the money on their side. We have all the power on ours.
Well, there you have it. Couldn't set up better myself. So look, you can always go, just go check out Berks Gas Truth, and that's gastruth.org. Look up Karen Faraday. You can check her out on Twitter, on Facebook, all around the place. We'll get links up to all this too, as well, in here. And Karen, thank you so much for taking the time out, especially at such a busy time when you've got, your octopus arms out trying to keep everything going.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm always so grateful for the opportunity to talk about all this craziness. So get in there and just help however you can.
Oh, you got it. Well, thanks again to Karen. So we will be back right after this for a short kind of last call for the day. Maybe we'll even have some word from Sean about which mountain he is on or fell off of. Who knows? We shall see where it goes. And hopefully we'll have some beer news for us too that I can share with you in the last call too as well. So again, thanks to Karen Faraday for Berks Gas Truth for bringing us up to date. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this break.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. And for today's last call, Don't have a whole lot for you. I had hoped to bring you some updates at this point from Woodlands Brewery up here in Marcy, New York, and from the Fulton Chains Brewery. But unfortunately, given the pain meds that I had at one point for this abscess tooth and antibiotics, I haven't been indulging in too much of the liquid libations, shall we say. So we won't have a whole lot of the report here. Instead, I think I'm just going to leave you all with just a kind of reminder to enjoy and soak up as much of the summer as you can for what's left of it as we move into the dog days of August. Let's hope that by the time we get to the podcast next week that Trump and his friends have not launched a nuclear war against North Korea, which seems to be one of the things that he's playing around with, as if it were just his, video game or something like that. It's pretty crazy. For next week's show, I'm not quite sure what we're going to do yet. There's a possibility that it might be another interview show like today. I've got a lead on a guy who's going to be he's writing about kind of the use of science and politics and things like this. He's got a new book out. We might do that for next week if we can hook it up. If not, we'll have some other special show for next week as we await the long-awaited return of Sean Kitchen to good old Pennsylvania. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm signing off for this week, and hope you enjoyed the interview with Karen Faradin from Burke's Gas Truth, and we'll talk to you very, very soon. I'm out of here. See ya!